All right, second half of chapter 4. The key case in libel law, and frankly one of the major cases in all of media law, arose in 1964 in the case of New York Times versus Sullivan. It's probably the biggest case we study in this class, and it is also the most important case in this chapter, and it really set the stage for the Supreme Court's more expansive reading of the rights of the press under the First Amendment. And it arose as a result of the ad right here that I've reproduced, taken out by a group of civil rights activists in the New York Times. Now, you can't read the text very well in that, but I'm here to tell you that it never mentions L.B. Sullivan by name, okay? Basically talks about the ways in which civil rights protesters were maltreated in the southern states. L.B. Sullivan was a city commissioner for the city of Montgomery, Alabama. And he took a look at this ad and said, "This ad defamed me." Okay? It never mentioned him by name. It talked about how southern officials had done wrongs against the civil rights activists. And only about 300 copies were distributed in Montgomery, Alabama. Now, there were a number of small factual errors that were in the text of the ad. For example, at one point the ad says that students were kept out of the cafeterias by chains. That didn't really happen. There were some small other things. But by and large, this was an act of political advocacy. But under the law of strict liability, the only things that Sullivan had to prove was that he had been defamed, that he had been identified, and that it had been published. Of course, we know it's been published. That's the New York Times. It's arguable whether or not he's actually been identified, but a jury believed he had. And, of course, naughty things. Things were said about these city commissioners or local officials in the southern states that weren't very flattering. So they met the burden of proof, and the New York Times was not able to say that it hadn't done these things. And so the Alabama Supreme Court awarded Sullivan $500,000 in damages, okay, even though he had not made any effort to demonstrate that he had been in any way harmed by the publication. Okay? The New York Times doesn't like this outcome, of course, and appeals. And here's the holding. Supreme Court says no. Okay? It overturns the Alabama Supreme Court's decision, and it sets the burden of proof at actual malice for public officials. Again, shift in the burden of proof. It used to be that the defendant had to prove that it hadn't libeled someone, and now the burden of proof rests on the plaintiff. And Brennan writes, that of course is Brennan there, "The constitutional guarantees require, we think, a federal rule that prohibits a public official from recovering damages for a defamatory falsehood related to his official conduct unless he proves that a statement was made with actual malice." And here's the definition. "That is, with knowledge that it was false, or with reckless disregard of whether it was false or not." In other words, Brennan is saying, in order for a public official to win a libel case, they must prove that the publication was made with actual malice. That is, that the news organization knew it was false and published it anyway, or, the magic or, didn't care one way or the other, published it without even considering whether or not it might be true or false. Again, a very difficult burden to meet. This is a very media-favorable outcome. Okay? What else did Sullivan do? Did a whole bunch of stuff. Again, the actual malice standard. I cannot emphasize this enough. You do need to know this standard. Actual malice applies to public officials and public figures, so congresspeople and presidents and mayors and city council members, or celebrity types, people who are famous, who are in the public eye, like Britney Spears or Kobe Bryant or LeBron James, whoever. Okay? And they must prove actual malice, which is the media either knew it was false and published it anyway, or didn't care one way or the other. That's reckless disregard. Okay? Again, the shift of the burden of proof, the importance of that cannot be overstated. The burden of proof means that the plaintiff must actually make the case that he or she has been harmed and has to meet all of those six elements of libel: defamation, identification, publication, falsity, fault, and damages. Memorize that any way you need to. Okay? Libel, again, a constitutional question. The First Amendment is a very important part of our Bill of Rights. And for libel to be under the First Amendment's purview makes it so that the federal courts may often get these cases even though they need to apply state law. And again, the importance of open debate. Brennan writes, "Debate on public issues should be uninhibited, robust, and wide open. Isn't that great language? And it may well include vehement, caustic, and sometimes unpleasantly sharp attacks on government and public officials. Brennan is essentially saying, look, if you're going to be a public official, you've got to have a thick skin. So, you know, man up or woman up and take your lumps, take your criticism. We're not going to punish the media for commenting on your performance because you are accountable to the public. And if you've got a thin skin and criticism bothers you, it's probably too hot in the kitchen for you and you should get out. Okay? Very, very, very critical case. I cannot emphasize the importance of the case enough. Okay. What is actual malice? Well, you actually can ask the reporter, ask the media professional about what they thought or believed or felt at the time the story was being produced. We'll talk about that case in a minute. Okay, they can examine the state of mind in the court. They can put the journalist on the stand. The kinds of evidence that a court will look for was, what sources did you use or not use? Did you only talk to people who were favorable to one point of view or the other? Were you under a deadline pressure? If it was hot news, there might be a consideration that you might not have gotten all the facts right in the rush to get the news on the air. The court will maybe give you a little bit of slack for that. And, you know, frankly, if it sounds too weird to be true, it probably isn't true. Okay? The court will take a look at the inherent probability or possibility of the facts making sense the way they are. Okay? And the case that said that you can put these people on the stand is Herbert versus Lando. It's a 1979 case where a retired Army officer talked with CBS for a documentary on Vietnam. And he said some things that afterwards he said were taken out of context, misinterpreted, etc. Okay? He claimed that CBS had basically libeled him, had portrayed him falsely. His attorneys put the CBS producers under oath, they deposed them, and said, you know, how did you make these editorial decisions? What were you guys thinking when you were creating this? You know, did you think that the information that he was giving you was true or false? Did you make any effort to corroborate it? Really asking probing questions about the whole news gathering process. CBS said, wait a minute here. We've got a First Amendment privilege to gather the news, and this is a violation. The Supreme Court said, no. If you are a public figure libel plaintiff, which Herbert clearly is, he's an Army officer, he may inquire into a reporter's or any media official's state of mind and actually ask tough questions about what that party was thinking about the truth or falsity of statements. In other words, in order to determine whether or not there was actual malice, they need to actually determine that by asking questions of the people involved in producing the work. Okay? And Herbert was also permitted to review CBS's outtakes from the interviews. Okay? So what this essentially means is that there is a right for particularly public figure libel plaintiffs, but also for private people to some degree, to ask the hard questions about determining whether or not an individual acted with actual malice in producing a story. All right. What's reckless disregard? The Supreme Court in several different cases has said you might be acting in reckless disregard if you have serious doubts about whether the publication was true or not. If you actually knew or you really thought that it might be false and you put it out there anyway. If you purposely avoided the truth, if you determined your way was the right way, and even though there was evidence to suggest it wasn't, you avoided that. Okay? So they're really, again, asking questions about how reporters or other news professionals deal with the information that comes to them and how they analyze whether or not something is true or not true. Okay? And again, reckless disregard means you published it without caring, all right? Or you knew it was false and published it anyway. Okay, a couple of post-Sullivan cases. I actually found a picture of a lazy judge. I think of this Garrison case as the lazy judge case. The reason this case is important is because it basically got rid of criminal libel, of the idea that you could sit in jail for criticizing the government. We also know that from Chapter 2 is sedition. Jim Garrison, who was the district attorney in Louisiana, called 8 New Orleans judges lazy, and the judicial branch actually sued him. Supreme Court takes the case, again, same year that Sullivan was decided, and overturns it. Brennan writes, only those false statements made with a high degree of awareness of their probable falsity demanded by New York Times may be the subject of either civil or criminal sanctions. For speech concerning public affairs is more than self-expression, it is the essence of self-government. In other words, It is the right and duty of the press and the media organizations in general, you know, to take a look at how government is functioning. In order for this country to be a self-governing democracy, Brennan is saying, you need to do more than simply report what they want you to report. You actually have to be able to criticize and consider what they're doing. Okay, so we no longer have criminal libel. Libel as a result of this case is primarily civil action. Okay? We don't throw people in jail anymore for libeling. All right, let's talk about a couple other post-Sullivan cases. Sometimes the Supreme Court takes two cases that have similar outcomes or similar questions and globs them together and decides them as one case. Actually, a case that we talked about in Chapter 5 was like that. The ride-along case had another case associated with it. But in this case, I think that that Berger case is less important than the one we talked about in Chapter 5. But in this case, the outcomes were different. Okay, so it's important to think about both of these cases even though they were decided together. Okay, in the Curtis case, that gentleman there is Wally Butts. He's the athletic director of the University of Georgia, very famous. And he had allegedly talked to Bear Bryant, also a very famous coach from Alabama, in advance of a game. And the Saturday Evening Post published some information about that alleged discussion. Okay? In the AP case, the AP, the Associated Press, dispatched, had alleged that former U.S. Army General Edwin Walker had led a group of white students to block black students who were coming to the University of Mississippi. In both cases, at the lower court level, both the general and the coach won $500,000 in judgments. But the Supreme Court upheld one case and overturned the other. Okay? The rationale is, the Post loses. Okay? The Post has a long, week-long, it's the Saturday Evening Post. It's published once a week. So they had a long time to check additional sources. They relied on a bad source. They didn't really bother to go back and check other additional information that had come to light, so the court determined that they had acted with actual malice. However, in the Associated Press's case, the Associated Press is on short deadline. They keep doing, you know, repeated dispatches of updates. They were responsible, they were consistent, under deadline pressure, and they actually tried to correct problems when they saw them. So again, similar cases in the sense that both plaintiffs won at the lower court level, but it helps us to define what actual malice really is. All right. Now, libel law has a very long and storied history, as we talked about earlier. But in 1971, the Supreme Court almost got rid of libel overall. How might they do that, you might ask? Well, it happened in a case called Rosenblum versus Metro Media. It's a 1971 case, and it was only good law for 3 years. So I'm really teaching it more as history than anything else, okay? What had happened was a radio station had called George Rosenblum a smut distributor. The city was doing a sweep of adult entertainment, and a radio program called Rosenblum a smut distributor after he was arrested in this obscenity campaign. Rosenblum was never actually convicted, but he filed a libel suit. And Brennan said, okay, first of all, he could only get 3 justices to agree with his side of the story, one himself and 2 other people. So we say that it has little precedential value when you don't have a majority. You have to have 5 out of the 9 for a case to carry any real weight. So in this case, Brennan could only get 3 votes, his own and 2 others. But what Brennan tried to do was say that when we're looking at a libel case, we've been looking at whether or not plaintiffs are public figures or private figures. Instead, Brennan suggested, maybe we should look at the matter. So what the journalist is writing about, or what the media organization is writing about, we should consider, rather than the kind of plaintiff the plaintiff is. We should look at whether the situation, the matter, is a public or private matter, rather than whether the plaintiff is a public or private figure. Now, this upshot of this would have been to eliminate libel, because as we know from New York Times versus Sullivan, when you apply actual malice to a situation, to a libel case, 10 times out of 11, or 9.5 times out of 10, you're not going to be able to get a win for the plaintiff, because actual malice is a really hard burden to meet. So if you knew that 9 out of 10 times, and you were a private or public, you know, dealing with a public situation, you were going to lose, why would you bother to bring a libel suit? So this case would have had the upshot of getting rid of libel. Now, the reason this case is important is because it illustrates how the Supreme Court was wrestling with how to manage the problem of libel. Okay? As it turned out, the court returned 3 years later to the public-private person dichotomy. All right? And it's in this case. The case is called Gertz versus Welch. Notice the number of stars. Okay? Second most important case in this chapter. Okay? That gentleman down below is Elmer Gertz. He was the Johnny Cochran of Chicago, a very high-profile attorney. He had been involved in rewriting the Illinois Constitution. He was, you know, a very high-profile, active kind of guy. But he took on a case of a private family who was a prosecuting for the family of the youth who was shot by a police officer. Okay, so he was representing this private family. A news organization called American Opinion had written an article about Gertz saying that his taking this case on demonstrated that he must necessarily be a communist who was interested in undermining law enforcement because he was prosecuting the state, okay, for the death of this kid. Gertz says, well, wait a minute here. Even though I'm a very popular guy, in this case, I'm just a lawyer representing a client. I'm just a guy doing my job. So I'm really a private person here. I shouldn't have to prove actual malice. And the Supreme Court says, you're right. Even though you're a very high-profile person, you know, really we're looking at the kind of figure you are. And in this case, you are a private person, and you need only prove negligence. Okay, so Gertz gets to win, and the Supreme Court backs off Rosenblum. They said that whole Rosenblum thing from 1971 where we're going to look at the matter and not the person, never mind. We're going to return to looking at the kind of figure to determine the kinds of fault that the plaintiff has to prove. Gertz did a number of other things as well. The Gertz court said that there is no liability without fault. What this means is that the court added that sixth leg to the libel table. Defamation, identification, publication, falsity, damages, fault. So if you can't prove fault and at least negligence, you can't even really bring your case because that kicks out one of the six legs of the libel table and the table falls down. So if there's no negligence, if you can't even get to negligence, you might as well go home. Gertz also said, if you're a plaintiff of either public or private status, you've got to prove actual malice to receive punitive damages. Now, as we're going to find out in a later case, in the Dun & Bradstreet case, there are some states that will allow a recovery of punitive damages on just a showing of negligence if you're just a private person in a private matter. But most of the time, if you are a private person in a public matter, you got to prove actual malice to get the big money damages. So basically, actual malice to receive punitive damages. Gertz also said that juries can't feel sorry for plaintiffs and award more money for compensatory damages than a plaintiff could actually prove. Let me give you an example. Let's say in my bad teacher example, I could prove $1 million for my $1 million paycheck, that I received from the university for teaching and research, okay? I can prove $1 million, but the jury really likes me. So they say, oh, we like that Belmas character. Even though she can't prove actual malice, we're going to give her $2 million because we just like her. The court said, no. If I can only demonstrate $1 million of compensatory damages, that's all I get, no matter how much the jury likes me. Okay? And the last thing that the Gertz court said was there is no such thing as a false idea. There is no punishment for expression of opinion. Now, this isn't really as good of a law as some of the other areas of law. Pure opinion is indeed protected, as we talked about in Milkovich, right? If something really is opinion, if it cannot be proven true or false, then it can be protected as opinion. But simply tacking on I think or I believe or putting it on the op-ed page is not enough to demonstrate it as pure opinion. If you can get to pure opinion, yes, then it is protected. But there are such things as false ideas. So this is one of the areas that Gertz that is no longer good law. However, the other three are good law, and it wouldn't hurt you at all to know that. All right. What constitutes negligence? Now, we know what constitutes actual malice. We know what constitutes reckless disregard. Negligence is really, you know, actual malice light. They look at some of the same things in a courtroom, but they keep it to a lower, you know, a lower burden. In other words, it's a lower threshold. Is there a discrepancy between what the source said and what the reporter wrote down or reported? Did they bother to check the spellings? Did they do basically what we would call due diligence? Did they make sure that all their, you know, T's were crossed and I's were dotted? Did they double check spellings of names and addresses and dollar amounts and other things that you should do as a good reporter? All right? Did they actually try to get all sides of the story, or were they just serving as a mouthpiece for one side? All right? And again, basic facts. I cannot emphasize this enough. No matter what area of media you're in, you need to make sure your basic facts are correct. Let me give you a public relations example. I went to talk about libel at a public relations conference here in Orange County. And a public relations firm had been retained to represent Canada. All right? And Canada wanted to claim that it was the largest trading partner with the United States, when actually that's not true. It happens to be either China or Japan, and I think they trade places. I think at the time it was Japan was America's largest trading partner. So had the public relations firm, you know, put as part of its campaign, Canada was the U.S.'s largest trading partner, you know, Japan might have been able to sue. Now, I don't know how they would have been able to sue countries suing each other. I'm not sure, quite sure how that would have worked. But by and large, you really have to be careful, even if you're in public relations or advertising, in checking those facts. Because courts tend to get hung up on making sure that all the facts, whether it's a news story or a persuasive thing, are all true. And you remember the Behrens, right? Make sure your T's are crossed. If it's Dr. Behrendt with a T or without, you better double check it and make sure that's the case.